Dogcast Radio. If you like dogs, wherever you are in the world, we're the show for you. Hello and welcome to episode 46 of Dogcast Radio. In this programme, we have a little bit of this.
The only way I could catch this dog was to get down on my tum, crouch down and come at the dog which was seated before me, and come at it from underneath and put a choker chain on it from underneath, because I was deferring to the dog's authority.
Some of this.
According to a 2006 survey by Simply Hired, almost half of dog owners would be willing to change jobs if it meant that they could take their dog in with them. Almost a third would take a slight pay cut to do so.
And a taste of this. And I'll be giving you my thoughts on small dogs. But before all that, we have an interview with Joy Turner, a renowned communicator and energetic healer for animals and humans. Joy hosts the radio show Talk With Your Animals and offers private communication sessions to her international clients. Animal communication intrigues me, and I was very interested in the offer that Joy could communicate with my dog Buddy. But my first question was, just how does she do it?
It's actually something that everyone is born doing. Most people just get taught out of it. It is, people will call it telepathy and empathy. It's really being able to be open to different levels of awareness than most people typically use, but we all have. And so basically if someone wants me to communicate with their dog, they would tell me the name, and depends maybe a little bit about the dog. That's all depending on what the dog wants. And then as you talk about your dog, you give me a thing that I call an energy signature. Everything is made up of energy, and therefore everything has an energy signature. And as you speak about your dog, you show me what that dog's energy signature is, and so then it's easy for me to connect to them. That's kind of the shorter answer.
Okay, and what, once you've connected with that, what kinds of information do they show you?
They can actually send me any kind of pictures. They talk to me in words, in feelings. They can send me smells. They can show me what their body is feeling like, what their emotions are doing. They can show me, for instance, what their feet feel like if they're walking on a certain kind of ground. They can pretty much anything, any sense that we have externally, we also have internally, and therefore they can send that information to me.
So it kind of depends what's on that dog's mind at that moment then?
Typically the way I do this is, rather than just connect with the dog and say, okay, tell me something, usually my clients have certain things they want to be able to talk to their dogs about. And so they'll ask questions, and I'll make sure that the dog understands the question, because they don't always understand exactly the way we intend things. So I make sure that the question is clear, and then when they respond to me with an answer, I then speak to the human and tell them that answer.
It's fascinating. I mean, you must have had some very memorable experiences during your work and your, you know, time with dogs.
I actually have a few things that are close to my heart that I especially appreciated. I can tell you about some of them if you'd like.
Yes, please.
Okay. And let me preface this a little bit by saying, again, dogs' understandings of things is not always, and actually most often, not as close to ours as we might think. So, for instance, I had a lady call me with a dog that she took everywhere with her, except when the families went on vacations, and then the dog got to stay home with a dog sitter. A dog sitter would come and live in their house and take care of this dog. And he was just a marvelously well-behaved dog every time except when the pet sitter was there. And so they thought, of course, that it had something to do with that particular pet sitter or something. They just couldn't understand, and it had gone on a number of times until she called me to find out what was happening. And, of course, knowing what's in the dog's mind makes it a lot easier to correct things or to come up with compromises. So when I asked him about that, first of all, he had no idea what a vacation was.
Hmm.
So I had to explain to him what a vacation was. And his interpretation of the occurrences was that she took him everywhere with her, except every now and then, for some unknown reason to him, she punished him and made him stay home by himself with a whole different person. And mm-hmm. he didn't know what he did, so he acted out to say, I'm confused, I don't understand, I don't know what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
So I asked her about the vacations, and as it happens, she is here in the United States. She would travel out of country and go to different countries, her and her entire family of birth, her mother, father, all those types of relatives.
Hmm.
And so anywhere she went, the dog would have had to have been quarantined.
Yes, yeah.
Once I found that out, I explained to him what quarantine meant, showed him pictures of what he would have been doing the whole time they were off having a good time and having fun. And he was horrified. He said, oh, God, he'd never want to do that. And I told him, instead of having his person stop loving him at certain times, she actually loved him so much that she would deprive herself of the pleasure of his company for his well-being and let him stay at home and where he would be comfortable and have someone come in that she knew would take excellent care of him and take good care of him while she was off. And once he understood this, I asked her, because, of course, she called right before she was going on another vacation.
Mm-hmm.
So I asked her to call me when she got back and let me know what occurred. So what happened with him was that he became the exact perfect dog that he had always been.
Oh.
He just needed to understand what was happening and why.
Yeah, yeah. You do take it for granted that your dogs understand what's going on. I mean, we moved house recently, and you kind of take it, you know, as that they will know, okay, this is where we live now. And it's a huge leap of understanding for them, isn't it?
Yes, it actually is. And as a matter of fact, I get a number of calls every month with people who have moved and their dogs are somethinging that they weren't doing before, whether it's becoming more reclusive or acting out. And it's because they don't understand what's happening. It's so important for people to explain from a human perception what's going on, because animals only understand from their perception, and very often, like this dog with vacation, they jump to the conclusion that you don't love them as much or you don't love them at all, depending on what's going on.
Are there any other instances you can share with us?
Oh, absolutely. Things mm-hmm. like, do you know agility? I'm assuming you have
yes.
agility in England.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Okay. A woman called me with a dog that was just totally excellent at agility, except for the weave poles. And that dog, she tried and tried and tried and could not get her to understand how to go through the weave poles. So she called me to find out what this dog exactly needed to know to be able to do this so that she could win, because, of course, I guess you get disqualified or something if you don't do one of the challenges that you're offered.
Yeah.
So what this dog did not understand, because her body parts typically functioned as one unit, and I guess on all of the other obstacles, they function as a unit, and the body doesn't have to do different things for different parts of it. But on the weave poles, everywhere from the nose all the way back to the tail is doing something different than the part ahead of it.
Mm.
Does that make sense?
Yes, yes, because they have to snake through it, don't they?
Yes, and she couldn't get that. So what I did was show her what it would feel like in her body to put her nose through the space first, and then as she was putting her nose through the next space, allow the rest of her body to snake through there and bend around that one pole. That was the part she couldn't get, because she would go her whole body through and then her whole body through the next one and her whole body through the next one.
Mm.
But, of course, that's not the way they're supposed to be done.
No, no.
So, and once she got that, once she understood the feeling of what it felt like to weave through those poles, according to her lady, she actually was able to do it. And I told her woman to please start out slowly to begin with, and then let her build up more speed as her body got more accustomed to that very unnatural, for this dog, movement. And now, according to what I'm told, she's doing fabulously through the weave poles.
Excellent.
So again, it's sometimes they just don't have the same understanding we have.
When you say you show her, you kind of envisage it in your head and convey that to her?
Yes, and not only do I show her the image of it, but I can also feel in my body what it would feel like to snake through those poles. And I would show her what my body would feel like, how every part would be articulated differently than the part ahead of it. And so she got not only the image of what she was supposed to do, because she could see in her own person's head what it was supposed to look like, but couldn't get there until I could actually show her my body feeling of what it would feel like to go through there. And then she could get the feeling and could do it.
Amazing. Joy, you can actually communicate with live and passed over animals, can't you?
Yes, that's true.
And
I talk with both of them.
Yeah, and is there any difference in how they, those two, you know, the live and the passed over animals, how they communicate?
Not typically. The only real difference that I feel typically is that the energy of the animals who have passed on is larger typically than the energy of that same animal when it's in a physical body. And that's because it's joined back more in the spiritual realm, where the energy is, of course, bigger individually than it is when we're in physical body.
So, does it come through clearer then?
Absolutely. Just as clearly as with a live body.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, I had a lady who called me because she wanted to actually speak with a dog that she was currently living with, and there was this other dog that kept coming into my mind, and I said, who else do you have that was very close to your heart and I think is crossed over now? And she told me the dog's name, and she didn't know what that dog might want, and when I asked him what he wanted, he had been living with this woman in a different home than the lady now lived in. And usually this isn't an issue, but with this dog it was. He kept going back to the old house trying to find the woman. And he couldn't find her there because, of course, someone else lived there now. So what I did was I explained to him that she had moved to a different place and tried to show him approximately where that was according to where the old house was. But he was having trouble trying to understand that, so I asked her to go back to the old house, just park out on the street, call his name, open her car door, close the car door after a minute or two, and then drive to her new home. And we arranged a time to do that so that I could be talking with Sard, that was the dog's name, and make sure that he was in the car and all of that sort of thing. And so she actually ended up driving him to her new house, and he showed up there for her to say hello to her quite frequently for a while.
You're aware of that, or she was aware of that?
She actually said she could feel him.
Most
people think they can't once someone's crossed on. They think that you can't feel them. And I remind them, if you ever had your eyes closed or were looking in a different direction and suddenly sensed your dog being present with you, and you turned around and there they were, it's that same type of feeling. It's just more subtle because there's no physical body with it. And so, sure enough, she said, you know what, I can feel him. And she did know for the next several weeks when he would pop in. She knew it most of the time.
That must be such a comfort for her.
It was. She loved it because this was like the dog of her life. You know how people will have many dogs that they adore, And most people very often will have a special dog that is somehow more special to them than all of the other special dogs that they live with.
Yeah.
And this was hers.
Oh. That's a lovely thing from your point of view. That's a lovely gift to be able to give someone and say, you know, there's peace of mind, or there's, you know, you don't have to worry about that anymore.
I adore what I do. It is my absolute passion in life. I can see doing this forever, and just, I love getting up in the morning. I love going to my office and work with people. I do most of my sessions over the phone because I do have people all around the world that I work with. I just absolutely adore what I do. I just can't imagine a better job for me than the one that I do.
I was going to say, it doesn't matter where people are, where they live. They can still contact you and ask you for help, can't they?
Absolutely. And they can do that in a couple of ways. Okay, they could call me in the United States, which is the country code of 11, and then it's 425-867-1779, or they can go over the internet to my website, and they can get to that website two ways. One is to go to www.talkwithyouranimals.com, and one is to go to www.joyturner.com. They'll both take you to the same website, and there is a spot, a page on the website that people can contact me and schedule for sessions if they'd like.
Okay. We'll pop links to both of those on our website to just to help people that get to you. That's okay. This gift you have, it must have been a wonderful help with the dogs that you share your life with.
It is. I can't even begin to explain to people really the depth of the relationship that you can have with the animals in your life when you can speak to them in a way that they all understand and you understand. It creates such a different type of relationship.
Now, is it, you know, you've said this is something we're born being able to do. So is this something that we can learn to do?
Absolutely. I believe that anyone who wants to can learn to do it. And in fact, I teach classes a couple of times each year to teach people, and over the years, everyone that's ever come to any of my classes has always left hearing more and being aware of hearing more than they were when they came. So there are many books out that talk about different ways. I'm told I communicate a little bit differently than a lot of communicators, but I was also born doing it, so I never lost that ability, didn't have to relearn it. And so it's actually my first language. It makes it very easy for me.
This always intrigues me. How did you realize that you had this ability? And, you know, when did it become clear to you that this wasn't something that most people can do?
Actually, since I've done it for as long as I could remember, I even can remember, as a matter of fact, I was born prematurely. So in my day, they put you in an incubator, and I remember my spiritual guides being around that incubator talking to me. So being that early in one's life that you're aware of this, the big question then really becomes, when did I realize everyone else didn't do it? Because for, the first 20-some-odd years of my life, I just assumed everybody was doing what I was doing. And it wasn't until I was almost 30 that a man that was a friend of mine at that point asked me if I had any idea how different I was. And, of course, I didn't. So he actually helped educate me about how things didn't happen to other people typically like they happened to me.
Yeah. Now, I think obviously we all dog owners, I mean all animal owners, but all dog owners really want to communicate with their dog, you know, as effectively as possible, whether that's for training or just to know what they're feeling. So can you give us any advice on if we want to sort of start connecting with our dog better, you know, and picking up on these things, how do we do that?
Okay. There's actually two parts to communication. One is the way we communicate to them. The other is our receiving communication from them. Mm-hmm. So let me tell you a little bit about both, if that's okay.
Yep, great.
And we'll start with how you receive information better from your animal kids.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I find when I do my classes, most people really need to do first is give themselves permission to receive this information, because over their lifetime, people have been told that it's not acceptable in one way or another. And a lot of times that will look like, for instance, parents telling children, don't talk to imaginary friends, or people will think that there's something not right with you. You can probably think of a number of different things in your own life that would have supported you not thinking that you should be talking with animals or they could talk back to you. We're told all the time that animals can't talk.
Mm.
Some people don't even think they have feelings, but of course that's silly.
Mm. Yeah.
So the first thing you have to do is give yourself permission to receive the information. And then it's really a simple process, although it takes some time in practice. What you need to do, a lot of people tell me that they can't meditate because apparently a lot of communicators say you need to meditate to be able to do it. I don't do it that way. I just have people take a stock of what they're doing. In other words, I ask them, what's your body feeling before you ask something of your animal kids? What is your body feeling? What kinds of thoughts are you having? Where are you emotionally? And then ask your dog something. And if you have all of a sudden thought or a sudden feeling or a sudden impulse, to begin with, you need to assume that that came from your dog. And the reason you have to assume is because of a thing called the subconscious mind. The subconscious mind is a creature of deletion, which means it doesn't let through any information unless you specifically tell it you want it. And the way you tell it you want it is by, first of all, acknowledging that you're getting it. The acknowledgement is the if something changes in you, assume that that's from your dog. That would be the acknowledgement. And then if you act on that, let's say, for instance, you ask your dog what game it would like to play today, and you all of a sudden get an impulse of tug, let's say, and then you go get a tug toy and play tug with your dog, that's then instructing the subconscious mind very emphatically that you want more of that information, so more of it comes through. So after you assume what's coming through, then you just have to keep doing that. You have to set it up so that initially, and I would suggest initially, by the way, that you ask questions or make statements and want information about things that you don't have a lot of emotional charge about, because emotions to us act like static for our ability to receive.
Okay.
So if, and I have this a lot with my classes, people come to classes and they really want to learn something because there's something that they're very emotionally charged that their dog is doing. And I always tell them if they run home that night and ask their dog about that, they might get the answer, but there's a greater probability that they might not because of their emotional attachment.
Mm.
So I usually tell people to start out with simple things, things that they don't have any emotional charge about. And then eventually you'll learn how to differentiate your own thoughts from those of your dog.
Mm,
does that make sense?
Yes. Yeah.
And so really it's more a matter of practicing to allow the information through. And the more you do it, the more the subconscious mind lets through. The more the subconscious mind lets through, the clearer it becomes. And then the more complex the questions are that you can ask.
Wow, it really is fascinating. It's very intriguing to me. Joy, do you think you could try and communicate with Buddy?
Certainly. Would you spell Buddy's name for me?
Buddy, it's B-U...
Oh, Buddy.
Buddy, B-U-D-D-Y.
Okay, and Buddy is your dog.
Buddy, yeah. Do you want me to tell you something about him?
What question, what would you like to know from him? Let me ask that.
Okay, right. We have three dogs. Buddy's our first dog. We've had him, he's four. Then my daughter had, my daughter's 11. My daughter had a puppy, a little Bichon Frise called Star. And so she came to live with us. And then about about 2 or 3 months ago, so fairly recently, we adopted a guide dog who's another Labrador, and his name is Tom. And I just wonder how Buddy feels about he's gone from an only dog to being one of three, and how does he feel, you know, that he fits in now, and you know, is he happy with being one of a pack?
Okay, hold on a second. I want to say hi to Buddy.
Okay.
Okay. He wants to know if you're going to let all the people that listen to you hear what he says.
Yes. Oh, yes, definitely.
Okay. So I'm telling him, yes, we are. Okay. He says he really still considers himself your only dog.
Yeah.
So he is your dog primarily?
Yes, yeah.
Okay, because he realizes that while the house has more dogs in it, Star isn't your dog, and Tom isn't your dog. They are just family dogs.
Mm.
And he says, besides, he thinks if we had 100 dogs, he would always be your dog.
Yep.
He says he knows you too well to feel threatened by other dogs.
It's funny you say that, actually, because we say this a lot. He seems to regard himself as not quite a dog, you know, and sometimes they're all together and they just all run outside, but a lot of the time he is inside and often with me, and the other two are playing, and you can almost see him think, oh, I'm glad those dogs have gone outside. You know, it's that kind of, he does see himself as a little bit separate, I think.
He does, actually, because he's somehow, and it's true, he realizes his body is a dog, but he does see himself as separate, distinct, and different from the other two, and the other two being very much the same.
Mm, yeah, yeah.
And he says he is, from time to time, very glad that they're occupying themselves so that he can do what he wants to do.
Oh, good. And he's happy?
He says, yes, he's delightfully happy.
It was actually an emotional experience when Joy was communicating with Buddy. If you would like to listen to Joy some more, or contact her, go to her website via the link on the Dogcast Radio site.
You're listening to Dogcast Radio on www.dogcastradio.com.
You can say any fool thing to a dog, and the dog will give you this look that says, "My God, you're right. I never would have thought of that." Dave Berry.
Hello, and welcome to the Dogcast Radio News Desk. I'm Kate.
And I'm Nick. In this edition, we have a special report on dogs in the workplace. We dog owners all know how beneficial our dogs are to our homes, but how do you feel about dogs in your work environment? Americans had the chance to take their four-legged friends to work in June, and the British have their Take Your Dog to Work Day in September. The event is a marvellous opportunity to show colleagues what great companions dogs make, and also to highlight the vast numbers of dogs in shelters waiting to be adopted.
You can find out more about the British and US Take Your Dog to Work Days through the Blue Cross and Pet Sitters International. If you would love to take part in this fantastic day, but feel a little nervous about how your workmates, or even your dog, will react, we've found some advice for you. The Poop site has tips for a successful transition from home to office, with ideas for how to reassure workmates and your boss, and how to ensure everyone enjoys having Fido in the office. The Paw Rescue site has suggestions on how to make the day successful and safe, with lots of practical advice about what equipment to take and how to raise money too.
Of course, some dog owners are lucky enough to be able to take their dog to work every day, and if that is something that appeals to you, check out the Dog Friendly site, which has a page of dog friendly employers. According to a 2006 survey by Simply Hired, almost half of dog owners would be willing to change jobs if it meant that they could take their dog in with them. Almost a third would take a slight pay cut to do so, and 70% thought a dog-friendly company allowing them to bring their dog to work even just for one day a week was an important employee benefit. To find out more about this, go to the Pup Life Dog blog site.
Of course, some dogs have to accompany their owners to work, as their job is to assist their person. Guide dogs, for example, never have to sit at home waiting for their owner to return from work. Although these dogs are highly trained and can easily cope with work environments, apparently some people are nervous about having them around. The Guide Dog site has some great advice about how to behave around a guide dog and information about the practicalities of them accompanying their owner to work.
While dog owners themselves obviously relish the chance to spend work hours with their dog, there are at least two sides to every story. And to read arguments in favour of and against dogs in the workplace, check out the Lifehacker Pet Peeves page. If you have successful, disastrous, or funny stories about taking your dog to work, do let us know. And right now, we've had enough of working like dogs, so it's goodbye from the Dogcast Radio News team.
Dogs need to sniff the ground. It's how they keep abreast of current events. The Ground is a giant dog newspaper containing all kinds of late-breaking dog news items, which, if they are especially urgent, are often continued in the next yard. Dave Barry.
Do you know what a knock-knobbler is? No, it's not the latest designer dog breed. Bernard Cartwright took on the role of dog warden for the city of Worcester, and his experiences in the job inspired him to write his book, The Knock-Knobbler. But Bernard didn't start out as a dog catcher.
Well, I did a number of things before I became a dog catcher. I became a dog catcher when I was 54. So I was quite on in life, Julie. I made television documentaries mainly.
Oh, right.
Social, religion, business affairs. Worked with Mother Teresa of Calcutta.
Oh, wow.
Filmed her on a couple of occasions. Things like that.
Yeah.
In fact, I was working on the dogs once as the dog warden, and I had to pick up this poor dog who'd been ravaged by hunger. And when I picked it up, it was so light, and it reminded me of Mother Teresa, because I had to hold her cardigan once. When, you know, she'd washed it hundreds of times in the home for dying destitutes. And this cardigan was just so light, it was like tissue paper.
Oh.
And that strange little link there brought me back to television filmmaking when I was working as a dog warden for Worcester City Council.
And what happened to make you change direction?
Well, the company I worked for, which was Central Independent Television in Birmingham, they decided to close the whole thing down. In fact, I was one of the Birmingham 600. I lost my job with lots of other people. So I had to find work. Had four children and a border collie called Strumpf to look after. Strumpf is a German for sock, as well as a French cartoon character.
Right.
And because I like dogs, I was very fortunate to get the job as a dog warden for Worcester City Council.
Yeah.
I had, in fact, made a film about the Birmingham dog warden. So when I went for the interview, it sounded as if I knew what I was talking about.
Which helps, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So you obviously needed a change of direction, and
I needed to pay the bills.
Yeah, yeah.
We sold a house. It wasn't a very pleasant time.
No.
I applied for 200 jobs, and I got this one.
Yeah. And what were the highs and lows of being a dog catcher then?
The highs and lows, well, gosh, so many. I mean, getting paid for walking patrol in the River Severn, getting paid for bringing puppies back to children.
Oh.
You know, those were the highs. Picking berries in the sun, the lows were being bitten, attacked, threatened with death, and having to deal with sadistic individuals. I can give you one example of that.
Okay,
if you like.
Smashing.
Want to start with a bad story.
Mm-hmm.
I'll read to you then from one of the listings. This
is listed as happening on Monday, the 12th of June, in the year 2000.
Mm.
The book is set around the millennium, you see, which is when I worked in Worcester.
Mm.
An incident later in the day, if it is to be believed, used a device of the devil. And I had to think twice before writing it here, but I do so now, to illustrate the total destruction of mutual understanding and sacred kinship, and not between people this time, but between dog and man. Secondly, it illustrates that there is no revolting cruelty to which humanity will not sink. I was patrolling the filthy path down to Diglis Weir, and just where the footway reaches the river, I fell in with a middle-aged man who sounded like an English dictionary. But in reality, he was a wicked, uncultured oaf who thought a lot about himself. He had with him a large black collie crossbreed, delightful dog, and he told me what he'd done. "The dog bit my wife once," he said, "bit her in her own kitchen, but I sorted the so-and-so out for it. I used to work on ships, you know, for the oil industry, and I have an old diving helmet, so I fixed it onto the dog's head and detached the taps and turned them on. Oh, you should have seen her writhing about in there." He started to laugh, this man did. "I could have taken bets how long she would live. She exhausted herself, and then I turned on the hot tap. She didn't drown." "No," and he laughed again, this man did. "Now," he said, "I only have to show the helmet, and she goes and lies behind the settee." Well, I nearly kicked this fella, and, as a dog would, I had no powers of arrest to stop this violation, and this man doesn't deserve one of my names, except that of perhaps smell, or better still, sadist.
Mm.
So that was an example of a very, very unpleasant story.
Yeah.
The thing I had to deal with. How would you like one which isn't as nasty as that?
Yes, yes, please.
Yeah, this is much better.
Mm-hmm.
This is the sort of story I love to write down in my book.
Mm.
It happened on the 29th of September 1999.
Mm-hmm.
And it starts like this, Julie. "This day I was eminently kissable and huggable." Now, the word pet comes from the French petite, meaning little one. Hmm? And I would like to think that pets are put here to help us live in their world, but they have really very little to give, except, of course, their love. And such a pet came my way today. A border collie puppy was handed in to the police after it was found lost in the St. John's district of Worcester. She was absolutely innocent and adorable, having an unusual sheen to her coat, an animal straight from the vault box, a shepherd's delight, surely destined for crufts. Despite the fact that she was sick in my cage, she's the only dog I really ever wanted to take home. Like most of her sort, this creature brought to bear on me her doleful eyes, those engaging compensations for the mute state which dogs so easily use to hold sway over our emotions. Well, I subsequently received a call from a family in Comer Gardens, correctly identifying their pet. Upon arriving to bring the puppy home, I was greeted by a string of children stretched out across the road. But just like the famous sequence from The Sound of Music. Before my dog van could come to a halt, I was swamped by all these people, parents and children, anxious to embrace both me and Roscoe the collie. So much so that I couldn't get the door of the van open for the press of the crowd. I was just swept away by a community full of embraces. It was like the liberation of Paris. And today, St. John's rang out with mirth. So there you go. That was a lovely day for me, that one.
Yeah. Oh, that must be a lovely feeling when you've brought together a family that loves their dog and given them their dog back.
Yeah. It was a Merle, this dog. I looked it up afterwards. It had this these eyes and the sheen on it. And when I was at up north at a collie trial, I saw one of these dogs and asked what it was, and they said, "Oh, that's a merle." Nice word, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. They are beautiful, those dogs. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Now, who or what is a knock nobbler?
The knock nobbler. The knock nobbler is an ancient Elizabethan term for a person engaged by a church to reject unruly dogs from acts of worship. So that's the bald definition of it. Now, what this person did, he was appointed by the church warden to use a great big pair of tongs, like sugar tongs, really, or something like that, to grasp these dogs and throw them out if they paid up during church. Mm-hmm. Now, what used to happen in those days is the whole community would go to church. So you had farmers, shepherds, the well-to-do gentry with their dogs, and they'd bring them to church.
Mm.
And so somebody had to keep them in order, and that was the knock nobbler. You also had to keep children in order as well. I chose it as the title.
Yes, yeah. There must have been uproar, mustn't there? Because I can imagine some people sort of saying, "Oh, you're not taking my dog out," arguing.
Yeah. But the tongs, I mean, there are one or two tongs available in museums around the country to go and see. They are quite big graspers. You've got a hold of a dog in one of those, they wouldn't easily get out. If I were to use one of them today, I'd be in a lot of trouble, I think. They're great big graspers, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, as you say, things were very different then. Do current day dog catchers have protection?
They do. They have leather, obviously leather gloves. They are a policeman's riot helmet, leather sort of tabard coat, and leather leggings. You've got to remember, you get a call from a school, say, as I did, and there's a Rottweiler in a playground, and you drive there as fast as you can. You get out, you might grab your noose with you, and you won't have time to dress up in all this, because it takes about half an hour to get into it all.
Yeah.
That's the problem, you see. It's all in an ideal world. It would be nice to protect yourself in that way, but you just don't have time.
No, you've got to get out there and, protect other people, I imagine.
You had to protect the public, so that had to be done quickly. And I had a number of instances like that.
Oh, dear. What was the most dangerous situation you were in?
Dangerous situation would be a Rottweiler, a stud male Rottweiler, who'd fallen off a wall, a retaining wall of a wood. Now, Worcester is a lovely city, as you can well imagine. It's got a wood called Perrywood in the city perimeter, and it's very steep, and there's a wall, a retaining wall, and this dog had managed to fall off this wall and was unapproachable. And I couldn't catch it with the noose, with the dog food. I used to open a tin of Pedigree Chum and throw it down. This dog wasn't interested. It was stunned. And the only way I could catch this dog was to get down on my tum, crouch down, and come at the dog, which was seated before me, and come at it from underneath and put a choker chain on it from underneath, because I was deferring to the dog's authority.
Yeah, yeah.
I was acknowledging this dog's supremacy over me by grovelling to it.
Yeah.
And that was the only way I could catch it.
Gosh.
The alternative would have been to have asked the police firearms unit to shoot it. And I thought, no, that's somebody's pet.
I'd
give it a chance, give it time. And I did, and when I got the choke on it, I just said, "Come on," and it came away as meekly as I am. And he went back to its own owner, who was, became a friend after that.
I bet, yeah. So why did you write the Knock Nobbler, or The Dog Catcher of Worcester?
Well, why did I do it? It was, I found myself unemployed. I found myself, as it were, an economic migrant from the black country going to pretty Worcester every day. And I thought some of you might be interested in this. It's a daily diary. It's contact with the public. It's around the millennium. So there might be a bit of history in it. Mm. And I just wanted to make people laugh.
Yeah.
But there was a lot more in it than that. It was just after the Labour victory, just after 1997. And it was said that the Labour Party wanted to attract Worcester women as the ideal voter in the same way as, you know, the Tories went for Essex woman and Mondale man in previous times. So I thought, why don't I keep a diary about Worcester women?
Mm.
And so I did. So a lot of the dog owners are female, and I recorded their stories in my book.
Yeah.
And that was part of why I did it.
Mm. It sounds really, really interesting. Where can people buy it?
Well, it's published by Para Press Limited. They operate out of Tunbridge Wells.
Mm-hmm.
And they can be contacted on their website at www.parapress.com. That's P-A-R-A-P-R-E-S-S, parapress.co.uk.
Mm-hmm.
Or by calling 01-89-25-12-118.
Okay.
So it's the novel is published by Parapress, and it's illustrated as well. It's an illustrated book. There's some lovely illustrations of dogs and the predicaments that I encountered.
Yeah. Yeah.
Some of it's hilarious. Some of it's sad. I try to recount my observations.
Really. Yeah.
And to have a bit of fun and to entertain people as well.
Yeah. Well, perhaps to close, could you read us, you know, one of your favourite bits?
Well, I could read you the Ten Canine Commandments.
Okay, smashing.
I indicated to Mr. Stan Leverett, who buttonholed me in Worcester, about his dog dominating his house. I indicated to him that you have to dominate the dog and not be dominated by him. This is a man who was complaining that his life had been turned upside down by a rescue dog he had. So I said to him, look, Stan, if all else fails, use the 10 canine commandments. So these are the 10 canine commandments, which I've devised and nothing to do with the Holy Bible. Rule 1, or commandment 1, if you like. No toast to be given to the dog at the breakfast table or morsels at any other time. Commandment 2. Any unprovoked growling and the collie is put outside. Rule 3. One meal a day after the dog has clearly seen you eat your supper as the dominant male. Rule 4. Plenty of walks, walkies all the time, but at a time of your choosing, not when the dog wants it. Vary the locations from the one he wants. Commandment 5. When out walking and he's pulling on the lead and pulling you over, just slow down and stop and then start to walk backwards. And he'll soon get tired of pulling you. 6. Move his sleeping basket to different places to assert your dominance over him as the dominant male. Rule 7. It's a bit of sexist language here. Women tend to make dogs soft and undisciplined through giving them too much fuss and nibbles. So you must arrange for a transfer of all this affection and all these tidbits to yourself, but in full view of the collie. Rule 8. Say goodbye to him when you go out to show him that you come and go without his hindrance. Rule 9. Keep Classic FM on during the day. I should say Dogcast Radio, shouldn't I? Keep Classic FM on during the day to calm the dog's spirit. And if kindness fails, you have to apply the tenth commandment, and that is a bucket of water. So those are the 10 canine commandments, which I hope will make your listeners laugh.
I think they will.
So now you know what a knock-knobbler is. Bernard's book is available from Parapress, and you can get to their website through the link on the Dogcast Radio site.
Moose was a Labrador Retriever, which is a large, enthusiastic, bulletproof species of dog. This is the kind of dog that if it takes an interest in your personal regions, which of course it does, you cannot fend it off with a blowtorch. Dave Barry.
I have to admit something. I have always preferred bigger dogs. My family has had larger dogs, Labs, German Shepherds, and they just always appealed to me. I used to say that I liked a dog you could give a good pat on the side, and a dog should be a dog. When my daughter fell in love with Papillons, I was disconcerted. After some research, we settled on another breed. But throughout, Jenny was positive. She wanted a small dog. To be fair, it made sense. She would handle a small dog better. But I still wasn't sure about life with a toy breed. Then Star came into our lives. The Bichon Frises we met at the breeders were charming, energetic dogs, but nothing prepared us for the whirlwind we brought home with us. She was a tiny scrap of not much more than curly white fur, but she didn't know that. In her mind, I'm sure she was a lion. And after the understandable first day nerves of encountering a large black dog, when all she had known thus far were small white ones, she was all confidence. She emerged from her crate on her first full day with us, tail up and ready to face whatever the world threw at her. It was Buddy, our Labrador, who was worried and a little afraid of this strange newcomer. Initially, I treated Star more like one of the rabbits or guinea pigs we had had. I simply couldn't believe that that tiny head housed a smart dog brain. She educated me, though. Petite as she was, she learned amazingly fast where the water bowl was, which room she was fed in, how to get into the garden, and much, much more. I fell for her, as we all did. And sharing your home with a smaller dog has a charm of its own. Cat-like, they can leap onto furniture, stalk along the backs of sofas, and settle for a snooze on your shoulder. One day, it was brought home to me how far I had travelled when I was discussing Star with a Mastiff owner, and I said how she was apt to bark and was an excellent watchdog. The Mastiff owner made a comment about small dogs being yappy, and my instinct was to leap to their defence. I wanted to say to him that he shouldn't deride, but admire such strength of character. What human would find the courage to defy a world of giants? Star certainly wasn't yappy. She was brave. I was amazed at the strength of my feelings. Star is always chin up and tail up. The only occasion I've ever seen her tail droop, and it was a very worrying day, was shortly after Tom, another large Labrador, arrived in our pack. The two Labradors vied to sort out who was boss, and their skirmishes were often very physical and unpredictable. Several times Star was trodden on as they battled. Her screams rent the air, and she would run to the safety of a human. After 2 days of this, she was found hiding in the bathroom, tail down, clearly unhappy. At the time, I thought she was physically hurt, but now I realise I was wrong. She was actually deeply troubled by the mystery of how these small puny Labradors could possibly lift their feet up high enough to tread on such a mighty bulky beast as herself. On reflection, you see, Star has no idea how little she is. She goes at life full tilt, and this is constantly flagged up by the contrast of her behaviour with that of our two Labs. If Buddy or Tom want access to the garden, they wait and whine. Star will throw herself repeatedly at the door in a way that is impossible to ignore. The first few times it happened saw us running to the door to deter the mad, violent attacker that must surely be trying to kick it in. On another occasion, Star found herself trapped in a room and threw herself at the door so violently, I went to inquire what DIY task my husband was carrying out. When found at the scene of a crime, a chewed-up slipper perhaps, the Labs will immediately assume a guilty, dejected air, as if to plead for mercy. Star will grab the evidence and prepare to run. The biggest proof of Star's lack of self-awareness is dinner time. I feed Star in a different room from the labs, and they are banned until she has finished eating. When she walks away from her food, I know she's had enough, and I let the labs in. Any food left in her dish disappears into a Labrador in a flash. I always wondered if perhaps Star resented this and would like the chance to return to her dish, but was scared to do so. Then one day I accidentally let Buddy and Tom in before Star had finished her meal. Two hungry noses headed for her bowl, but a small white one beat them to it, and a fierce growl emanated from it. Star stood over her food, and the two labs backed off. It was a comical sight, as a fluffy white lapdog munched her breakfast at her leisure, while two hefty gun dogs sat patiently, great strings of drool dangling from their jaws, but neither daring to approach the dinner bowl. It proved to me that none of our dogs have a clue of their relative sizes, and it doesn't matter, because ultimately it isn't the size of the body, it's the size of the spirit that counts, and little dogs are blessed with an abundance of that.
Unlike cats, dogs never scratch you when you wash them. They just become very sad and try to figure out what they did wrong. Dave Barry.
We brought you the sad news about Jill's poodles being imprisoned under suspicion of sheep worrying, although there was no solid evidence against the dogs. The even sadder news is that the dogs are still imprisoned. The good news is that Jill's husband has seen the dogs, who seem to be in good spirits, and the dogs have also seen a vet and, at last, a groomer. Many people, including Jill's solicitor and MP, and of course Jill herself, are still hard at work to resolve this happily, and there are glimmers of hope that the girls will soon be home. But in this case, it seems that no sooner is there a glimmer of hope than it is stamped out. Jill and her family are still living with the strain of this constantly over them. Any dog lover will understand the nightmare that this is, and one dog lover who is certainly outraged is Dogs Today publisher and editor Beverly Cuddy. Beverly is passionate about dog welfare and has been providing updates and comments on the poodle's plight, amongst other subjects, in her Cold Wet Nose blog. There's a link on the Dogcast Radio site to Beverly's blog, and I do recommend you check it out. We were contacted by a listener recently with a problem. I'll read you his email. Hi Julie, just came across your site. I have a new fee called Indy. She is 4.5 years old and I rehomed her a little while ago. She is the light of my life. I am 76 years old and was scanning the web to try to find a second-hand grooming table, one that will lift Indy up to a level that I can groom her, and also an air blaster to blow dead hair from her coat. Any of your listeners could have any of these items for sale? Let me know. Newfoundly yours, Derek Mussel. Well, Derek and Indy live in the Essex area in the UK, so if anyone can help, please do let us know, and we'll put you in touch with Derek. In our last episode, I interviewed Jane and Tony from Trover Coats, and we talked about jetty dogs. There is a new world jetty dog champion, and to celebrate this, Trover Coats have brought out a single called Walkies, which you, as a Dogcast Radio listener, are getting a sneak preview of right now. Great, isn't it? Jane says, the world champion is a greyhound no one wanted because he was not a winner on the track, but can he jump? A failure turned into a great success. What a wonderfully positive message, and if you'd like to download the single, you can do so from www.trovercoats.com. We'll be attending a Jetty Dogs demonstration later in the summer, which I'm really looking forward to, and we will, of course, bring you coverage of it. Till next time, look after yourselves and your dogs.
dogs have doggy panache, and some have style and some have grace, like top dog, jumping jack, splash. The water's deep, the water's clear.
Thanks for listening to Dogcast Radio, available from www.dogcastradio.com. That's dogcastradio.com. If you'd like to get in touch with us, and wherever you are in the world, we'd love to hear from you. You can do so in a variety of ways. By phone from the UK, you can contact us on 0121-288-0922. From the US, you can contact us on our American number, which is 315-849-2022. From any other country, you'll need your international exit code and then 44121-288-0922. You can contact us on Skype with the ident Dogcast Radio. That's all one word, Dogcast Radio. By email, you can contact me on julie@dogcastradio.com. When contacting us by email, if you have the facilities, please record your questions or comments and send them to us as an audio file. That way we can include them directly in our programme. We can accept most formats, for example, WAV, MP3. All these methods of contacting us can be found on our website, which is www.dogcastradio.com. And as ever, the final word goes to Jenny.
When is a black dog not a black dog? When it's a greyhound.